Welcome to another episode of The Neil Damrell Show with your host, myself, Neil Damrell, founder of Damrell Coaching, bringing you simple and honest advice on all things cycling related, helping you to cycle faster and recover quicker. Plus, sharing my personal experiences on all things health, wealth and mindset. So without further ado, let's get into today's episode. So welcome back to the show. And today's episode, I'm excited to introduce a special guest. So I've been working in the background to try and get a few more guests on the show. And we've got a few more coming up in the coming weeks, which is really exciting. So stay tuned for a lot more guests coming on the show in future episodes. But in today's episode, I've been lucky enough to interview Chris Opie. So you might know Chris Opie from his time on GCN. Chris is an avid cyclist and ex-professional cyclist living in Cornwall. He's a two-time world record holder, Lapierre UK brand ambassador, content manager for Lacole, and husband and dad. So he enjoys riding his bike as much as we all do, as often as he can, staying fit and healthy. And he also mentioned that he loves to compete as much as he can, when he can, in multiple disciplines around the sport of cycling. So first of all, I'd like to say thank you very much for Chris for coming on the show. It was a great chat. We discussed everything from his history in cycling, what inspired his journey through cycling, and his issues with fueling correctly, and maybe how he went about that in the wrong way when he first started cycling, and the pressures of getting to a lower weight when it came to performing well on the bike, and also how he's transitioned into the job role that he does now. And also other aspects in terms of the safety and the affordability of cycling within the UK at the moment, and how it's becoming more challenging for amateur cyclists to race and compete at certain levels. So it's a really good, insightful episode. We're going to get into the episode and let you decide for yourself. I'd like to apologize though, because we have lost a little bit of audio. So it kind of cuts off towards the end of the show, unfortunately. We had some recording issues with the Wi-Fi, so the last 10 minutes where we're wrapping up the show, we lost a bit of good insight for audio and video. So I do apologize on that front. Hopefully we'll get Chris back on the show maybe in a few months' time to discuss some topics that we missed out on with the audio. But hopefully you enjoy the show. If you want to get in touch with Chris himself, all of his social media links will be in the show notes to this podcast. So you can reach out to him, ask him some questions personally. Really open, really great guy to have on the show. So without a shadow of a doubt, let's get into today's episode. Perfect. All right, Chris, thank you very much for coming on the show. Really glad to meet you and spending your time with me this afternoon. For everyone that's watching and listening, just give us a little rundown of who you are, a little bit more about your backstory and, you know, your involvement within the world of cycling, so to speak.
Hi, Chris Opie. I grew up wanting to ride bikes and race bikes and do everything on bikes. So I started cycling in the 1997, having watched the Tour de France, been to the local bike shop, and decided quite quickly, I love cycling. This is what I'd like to do with my life, and pursued the goal of becoming a professional cyclist. Whilst I probably never achieved the level I may have dreamt of, I had an absolutely fantastic career that I'm actually very proud of and really enjoyed. I retired from racing in 2018 and joined the Global Cycling Network as a YouTube presenter. I really didn't enjoy that and decided to return to racing. Then we had COVID, so the planned return to racing didn't work out. And then I just completely fell back in love with enjoying riding a bike, not just racing, just enjoying spending time on a bike, riding as little or as much as possible, trying to do lots of different things. I've always loved every other discipline of cycling, and now I try and do as many of those as possible. I now work for Lacole and host 4 training sessions each week for the Lacole Cycling Club on Zwift. We create free to download training plans, and I'm a Lapierre UK ambassador.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Chris. What was your inspiration initially? Obviously, you mentioned the Tour de France back in 1997, but was there any other people around you at the time, friends and family or people that you used to hang out with, that sort of inspired you to get involved in the sport as well?
Nope, absolutely not. We went to the local bike shop one day when I was 9 to pick up a puncture repair patch, and there was an advert for a 100 kilometer randonnée, which is, it still exists today. It's a charity event at the time. It was called the Rosie Ride back then. It's now called the Bob Mansbridge Memorial. And I think jokingly, my mum had said to my dad, oh, you and Chris could do that. And we did it. It took 6 hours 25. To my knowledge, I'm still the youngest person to have ever done it. And that was it. As soon as that was completed, it was sort of, what's next? What more can I do in the world of cycling? And I absolutely loved the feeling of being on two wheels. And it just spiraled from there.
Were you always interested in the pursuit of the endurance side of things? Obviously, at that age, at a young age, that can be quite demanding and challenging, where for me, growing up at the age of 5, I started playing football. So I always kind of generally went down the traditional route, I suppose, within the UK, where football is quite a big sport. And, you know, cycling's got better and more accessible now. But at the time, that probably wasn't the case for you. Was that, what was the draw when it comes to the physical side of things as well?
I think it was the first thing I'd found physically that there was no proof I was bad at. So I can run to save my life. I can't kick a ball, catch a ball, throw a ball very well. Not into surfing. The water's too cold. Rugby, which is a big sport in Cornwall, doesn't interest me whatsoever. And to be really honest, I love being fit and healthy, but just wasn't that gifted at sport. And cycling was the first thing I'd tried where there was zero proof that I was bad at it, because no other children did it my age locally. And even when you went to the races, there was maybe one or two other children at the time that were under 12, so 10 years old. So it was this false hope of, oh, maybe you're good at this. And then if you practice something enough, eventually you do become better at it. And it was enjoyable. Just the feeling of being on two wheels was enjoyable. I really wanted a race, because to have a career in the world of cycling at the time, to me, the only obvious way of doing that was racing. And that also meant, of course, you could ride your bike lots. And it grew from there. And eventually there was proof that actually, not only was I not bad at it, I was actually okay at it. And if I always had this feeling that if I was to work hard at it, I could improve. And I'd never had that with anything before. And it was the first, and it's probably to this day still the only thing that I've really stuck with throughout my entire life, where there would be other fleeting hobbies or interests which come and go within a period of weeks when I was younger. And cycling is it. It's all encompassing. It's taken over my life completely, which is good.
Was there any particular athlete at the time? I'm a big fan of the Tour de France and started to watch it around that age as well. Was there any particular rider that inspired you at the time?
Yes. Although weirdly, it was Marco Pantani, a tiny Italian climber who had a very tragic story, ultimately, as many cyclists from that era did. His was particularly sad. He was exciting to watch. He was charismatic to watch when racing. He didn't adhere to the modern principles, even back then, of the modern principles of training properly. He would race on feel, and he was exciting to watch racing. And he was a sort of early inspiration, to the point where he used to wear a bandana. This is back in the era where helmets weren't compulsory in professional racing. So he'd wear a bandana, and I'd have a replica of one of these and a Marco Pantani saddle. I always found him really exciting. And then I grew up and I realized that he was completely the opposite to what I would be as a cyclist. And then finding new inspiration in riders like Eric Zabel at the time, or some of the other sprinters from back then, that became the sort of rider that I could recognize myself in more. So the inspiration, it's not really inspiration, but they became the riders you would look to understand how a performance for a certain body type would look.
And did you always found that you gravitated more towards explosive power and as a sprinter, or did you find you enjoyed climbing, or did you just find that naturally by riding more?
Yeah. So I think as I hit puberty, I suppose, I was very light and young. So when I was 16, I went to the Youth Olympics and I was still 61 kilos. But then the next year when I turned 17, I'd grown. I had lots of stretch marks on my back and I was no longer under 70 kilos. So it's 10 kilos and height growth within a year. And that's really when I changed. I'd always had an explosiveness. Like, we do lots of hill climbs in the UK and I used to do quite well in the short ones. And actually, even when we raced abroad in the Netherlands when I was younger, we would do two hill climbs in each week-long stage race. And it was quite rare that I wasn't first or second in them. So the explosive power, the sub 2 minute power, was always something that was obvious I was going to be good at, and also racing on the track when I was going up as well. But it wasn't really until I grew that I noticed that actually that would probably be all I'd be good at. And the longer efforts weren't going to suit me in the same way that they had done previously. So it was quite a long period of understanding throughout my junior racing years, when I was 16, 17, 18, and then into the years of being an under 23. It was a long journey of discovery of, you have to accept you're going to be a different type of rider to what you perhaps hoped. And this will be the only way you'll ever win bike races, and that will be through sprinting.
Did you become a fan of that discipline, or did you always like climbing as well, and then just failure to sort of prepare yourself that I'm going to have to put that one to the side to be better at the other?
Yes. Once that growth had happened and the change in my body had happened, I wouldn't say I ever enjoyed climbing again. I never felt light in the same way that I had done previously. And that was a real challenge. I raced in France as an under 23, and I arrived weighing 69 to 71 kilos. And they were like, no, this is too heavy. You need to lose weight. So I really challenged throughout that 2006 season to lose the weight that they'd wanted. And along with it, I lost all of my energy and power. And that was really the moment that consolidated, this isn't going to work for you pursuing this journey. You need to really just accept you're built in a certain way. And that helped, actually. Unfortunately, it would have been nice to have had the success help, the results go well, and to say that this is definitely the right direction. But actually, I think sometimes you learn from mistakes just as well.
And what was your transition then from just like an amateur cyclist into the world of professional cycling? How did that journey evolve for you? What kind of challenges did you face along the way?
That was painfully slow. So the year in France, I really struggled with to lose weight. I wouldn't eat breakfast, and then I'd go training, and I wouldn't eat when you came home either, because I'd tried everything up until that point. So the only real way that I could lose weight was by not eating. And you'd have soup and a bread roll in the evening, and then maybe eat something the next morning again. So just doing relentless days like that and having no energy was incredibly demanding. Off the back of that, I then had glandular fever. So the first year that I raced back in the Netherlands in 2007, I'd gone there expecting to do really quite well, because I'd done well there as a junior and a youth rider. And it was just illness after illness. And eventually, after 8 months of racing that year, in the August, we found out it was glandular fever, and then had a period of time off. Exactly how long, I can't remember. But the first race I did was the 1st of June, 2008. And I won it, which was a nice surprise. And that was quite reassuring. That was the first sort of moment of proof as an adult that it can still be a career that you can pursue if you want it to be. And in fact, there's a photo just at a shot there of another big win a few weeks later of a race in Antwerp. And this was another glimmer of hope of, if you keep pushing and keep working hard at this, it will be okay. You will achieve what it is you'd like to achieve. But it was a really difficult transition. And those early years as an elite cyclist, trying to become a professional cyclist, were just full of setbacks and crashes and things going wrong. It wasn't until 2011, so quite a few years later, racing back in the UK, at quite a low level, racing the UK scene, which at the time was really good. It was the build up to the Olympics, so there was lots of money in cycling. Everything was exciting. The Tour Series, which was a big city centre race series with 10 to 12 rounds at the time and televised, that was huge. They had some of the best circuit race riders in the world coming to do that, from Australia, from America, Spain, France. It was massive. There were the crowds of tens of thousands. It was a really exciting time to be involved in cycling. And it was only then, in 2011, when I had the help of a coach called Steve Benton, that things finally started to click. And whilst the professional team I'm about to reference wasn't quite the level that I'd aspired to race at, it was at least a level that meant I could do it as a career. So that was a team called UK Youth, which was run by Nigel Mansell, the Formula One driver from the 90s. And that was one of the best educations you could have ever had, actually, racing under a team under Nigel's guidance, because it was very, very strict. Everything had a very, very well outlined reason. Nothing was ever left to chance. Things didn't happen by accident. So in 2012, race with them, And it was a really good season, but it wasn't fantastic. There was lots of good results, but not amazing results. It wasn't until the next year then when we had just a string of really fantastic race results as a whole team. In fact, we were easily the most successful team in the UK at the time. And we were all able to achieve results at a really good level. And that was when everything finally started to feel like it was a professional job. It was a real career, even though the team wasn't registered at the level that I'd perhaps always aspired to race for. At least the results were at the correct level and we were able to do the races that we wanted to. So I say we collectively, I refer to a few teammates of myself who had a fairly similar journey in different ways. But it was only then in 2013, so 5 years after, 6 years after turning senior, that things started to click.
During that time, what did you find was a challenge financially? Because I've just been speaking to other professional cyclists, younger cyclists coming through, and obviously with the investment in cycling is probably a little bit less at the moment. At the time, how did you find that transition from, then how did you support yourself or family support you before you were getting paid to be able to support yourself? How does that work for you?
Yeah, so that's an interesting one. So on and off, I actually was paid at different times a teeny tiny amount. There was obviously some sort of support from home. It didn't cost much. So living in France, the team paid the accommodation, food for a lot of the time. We didn't have to buy either. The team paid me 150 euros a month, which back then, considering the amount I was eating, was actually enough to survive. And then in the Netherlands, I lived with a Dutch family. And again, the cost was minimal. It was 50 euros a week, and that included all of my food. So it wasn't like any of this was an expensive pursuit at the time. Once you'd had the ticket to travel to get to the location, everything else was taken care of. When we moved back to the UK, I supported myself with different jobs. And as a household, I lived with my partner, Micah, then already, and my wife. She worked, and I did the bare minimum in order to sustain some sort of cycling result. But the teams I rode for, they paid expenses and they supplied the equipment. So it wasn't like nowadays where some riders are paying to be part of a team and paying for their equipment. It's quite a big change. Back then, there was definitely more support, maybe because fewer people did it. So there was more support available. Whereas now, any support is probably spread quite thin because cycling is more popular. And then into the UK Youth Times, once that was a proper salary. The salary even 10 years ago then actually isn't that dissimilar to my daily salary now. So it wasn't a bad time to be involved in cycling. And I think that's a large part. We were talking this morning, actually. I don't know that it would have been possible had I wanted to do it now. If I was 15 years younger, I think it would have been a real challenge.
Yeah, I suppose that also allowed you to then fully focus on the cycling and get the most out of your performance as well, without the headache of, you know, the financial burden as well. Yeah. Is that right, saying?
Yeah, definitely. Certainly once it became a salaried job, it was much easier because all of the other things that were ever a concern just disappeared, and you could just wake up, okay, today I have to do X amount of training, X amount of intervals, I have to eat this much, go back to bed at this time. And the other thing that helped at the time was actually we had our firstborn in that first season of it being my job. So you had a real focus of, this is quite serious now because I'm now very responsible for the life of a tiny person. And if I don't do what I need to do, not only do I lose my way of life and my career, but also I won't be able to provide for them at home. So it was a really perfect time of motivation and the cycling environment and everything at the right time, really.
Yeah, just all come together basically at harmony to be able to then skyrocket your performance as well. So
yes.
We definitely want to touch back on, you know, the investment in cycling. I had a few questions come in from some followers that were keen to ask you some questions related to British cycling and the investment now. I wanted to go back to what you mentioned about your losing weight when you're in France and the challenges you had there. Because it did, I mean, you could correct me if I'm wrong, but I was just Googling and looking at your Wikipedia. It mentioned that you suffered with a bit of eating disorder based on that. You could correct me if that's completely wrong. Was that the case? Did that impact your ability to be able to feel well and just, you know, look after your body in a healthy way when it comes to managing your weight alongside for cycling performance?
Yes, definitely. So in 2006 in particular, I weighed 69 to 71 kilos when I went to France in January. And by May, I had managed to get my weight down to 63 and a half kilos. They wanted me to be 64. And for the first few months, nothing changed. I couldn't do it. So I just decided, as I said before, I'd just eat the absolute minimum. I've been told a story of an Estonian rider who also went to France, and he'd lost weight throughout his time there. And this is by the masseur who thought that I should lose weight. He told me, kept on telling me these stories. I can't remember his name, which is annoying. But anyway, he'd only eat soup in the evening. So that was it. I'd focus on only eating soup in the evening. And then eventually I got down to the weight that had been requested, and he was really happy and really impressed. Then he turned to the other English rider at the time and he said, does he eat normally? And Jonathan Rosenbrier, he was called, he worked the last time I saw him for EF Education as their press officer. Anyway, I turned to him and he scoffed and laughed and he said, what do you want me to say? And that's when I realized that, oh, maybe it isn't normal how I've been eating, because everything up until that point had informed me that it wasn't that abnormal to not eat. And I just assumed that it was what you needed to do. Anyway, no, apparently it wasn't normal. So yes, it took a long time to have a normal relationship with food. And to be really honest, I think for the entire duration of my racing career, I didn't have a normal relationship with food like I do now. So there'd be periods of restriction followed by periods of overindulgence. And that is never conducive to good performance, because your body's either starving or it's being overfueled and it constantly doesn't really know what to do with it. Whereas if I was to race again now, you just eat when you're hungry. If you need to wear out your food because you need to eat more and ensure you're fueled, you do. Back then, we would nearly never eat when we were training, and you would never eat until halfway through the bike race. And it is such a contrast to how fueling is approached now. Fueling is as important as the training, as important as the sleep, as important as off bike training, as important as mentality. It now has the focus that it deserves. Whereas back then it was almost like a mystery to, certainly in France at the time, and throughout lots of Northern Europe. I did a nutrition course when I was racing, and this is in 2016. And even that is so outdated compared to the advice that's available now. It's the biggest thing that's changed, the approach to eating and having a normal relationship with food is something that it took retirement to solve. And I think actually it took retirement the second time. I think even when I was aiming to race in 2020, there were still periods where I wouldn't have eaten enough, because that lingering belief of you have to be as light as possible was still there. Whereas actually that's not true. And last year and this year, not so much this year, but last year especially, I was able to beat some of my own Strava KOMs, even though I'm 6 kilos heavier. Obviously it takes a lot more power, but it shows that it is possible. And they're not short or easy ones. They're quite steep or they're quite long. So it's power is always going to be better than power to weight, if you have the power to weight as well.
Do you feel there's still like a stigma with cycling and managing people's weight and looking at that, especially on and off the bike? Because I work with a lot of amateur cyclists that are trying to lose weight, and obviously there's still a stigma that you have to be as light as possible, or you might have to restrict in the way that you've done to get your weight down, and it might only be for a very small period of time if they're planning to go on holiday to Mallorca for a week and want to be in the best condition possible, or a race or anything like that. Do you feel that's still something that needs to be worked on within the industry?
I think it depends the era that the cyclist started now. I think if you were to start cycling now, that probably wouldn't affect you as badly as it would have 10 years ago. Certainly not as badly as it would have 20 years ago. I think if you were to start cycling now, there is enough information out there that should prevent you from making poor decisions, such as trying to starve yourself to get down to a weight. I think there is enough information about how much fuel you need when training and then when recovering that wasn't out there before. And the dawn of the internet has helped that. But if you cycled lots in the 90s and you're coming back to it, or you cycled lots in the early 2000s and you're returning to cycling, I think there is a real chance that the beliefs that were ingrained in you back then will still override any of the education you give yourself now.
Yeah. And where do you see most people making the biggest mistake? Obviously your coach as well, and you help out with Nicole, where, obviously the people that you've coached and work with, where do you see the biggest mistake happening majority of the time when it comes to fueling? Is that like more riding fueling or off the bike fuel?
I think not eating on the bike is the worst one. I think chronic underfueling and underhydration, because we can only carry 2 bottles. And for most people, they think, I don't want to carry a 750ml bottle because it doesn't look good on my beautiful bike, whatever bike people choose to ride. Whereas actually, if you look at my bike, I only have 1 bottle cage on there. Whilst I don't do huge rides, that should definitely be 2 bottle cages for 2 hour rides. And it's a mistake. Underfueling, underhydration, it's not doing your body any favors at all. It's just making life harder for your body. It's having to look for energy sources that aren't necessarily readily available. Whereas if you were to fuel yourself and you were able to do your intervals well fueled and do them properly, you're less likely to have a bad day on the bike. You're going to recover faster than you would otherwise, and your performance will continue to improve, and it will sustain good health off the bike. Your energy levels will be better, and on the whole, life will be more enjoyable.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, how did you find your fueling when you did the Trans Pennine? Because I haven't seen your full Lecole video because I didn't realize it was on Lecole's YouTube channel until I Googled it the other day. But how was that in terms of managing your fueling, obviously for such an endurance event like that itself?
It was easy because I have a good appetite. I think the intensity that we rode at probably didn't require anywhere near the fuel that I consumed. And I think also the way that we actually broke it down into stages, which meant that we never did the full, let's try and do this in one go or as fewer stops as possible, like some would have. And I think that would have changed it a bit. I think we definitely had a lot of very sugary carbohydrates and very enjoyable indulgence foods from the French supermarkets. It was as close to a working holiday as you could ever get on 2 wheels. It was absolutely fantastic. But yeah, fueling was not a problem.
Yeah, that's good. And that's the first time you've done anything of that significance in terms of endurance based when it comes to cycling yourself?
Yes, absolutely. I've done one ride that was 460 kilometers. I've done two rides over 400 kilometers, but it's very different to do an isolated ride to doing a point-to-point of 1,000 kilometers, and also the elevation gain through the Pyrenees was really challenging. So that really was a mindset challenge rather than a physical one. I think once you've done one ultra endurance event, mentally you need to do one to learn, and then after that, I think it's almost like you realize that there's a whole new world there waiting for you. Once you've convinced yourself that it's something you are capable of doing, it opens up this amazing community of cyclists, and being part of what they do and what they achieve is really quite special.
How did you transition that way in terms of your mental well-being? So as you mentioned before, when you sort of left being a professional cyclist and then going to GCN, and then you wanted to go back into racing, you found that transition quite challenging. You know, have you supported your own mental health, and has what you've been doing now with the Trans Pennine and the other races that you're slowly getting back into, how has that sort of helped to reestablish a, you know, healthier mindset around the sport itself?
So I think the big thing that I need in my life is to ride bikes regularly and not pretend I'm riding bikes. And that was the issue at GCN, really, was there were at least 9 days of office time for every one day you could spend outside filming. And then filming also isn't a bike ride. Whereas now I can ride my bike every single day because I don't have a long commute. I'm not tied to an office between 9 and 5:30. So that's the biggest difference, actually, just having the freedom to plan my own time. So at Lecole, we are treated like adults. There's no other real way of saying it. If we don't do our work, we obviously are going to get found out. So you do the work, do it to the best of your ability, but you also have the flexibility to decide exactly when you're going to do it. And that makes a big difference for someone that was, as a cyclist, you're essentially self-employed. You're planning your own day from the moment you wake up to the moment you go to sleep, and to lose 20 something years. So from 2003, 15 years, from 2003 to 2018, planning my own day from the moment I left school to the moment I retired. Once that had gone, that was a real struggle as well. Also, I wasn't ready to retire. That was a large part of why I found it hard. So there were lots of reasons why that was a challenge. And likewise, there are lots of reasons now why it's very enjoyable. But I think the main one is having the ability to manage my own time and be in charge of my own destiny, and what I do in a day, in a week, in a month, in a year really makes a big difference. Riding regularly outdoors is one of the most important things. I need that feeling of being outside. I need to try and do that as early as possible each day. If I don't, even today, I've not ridden my bike, and get to the afternoon, you start to feel a bit slow and sluggish. Whereas if I wake up in the morning and I go, then I feel really good, and that sets me up, as it were, for the rest of the day.
Yeah. It's an interesting perspective from the inside. Obviously, GCN is a very big channel and do some really good content. Obviously, seeing it from your perspective, it looks like they're riding all the time because they're putting out a lot of content, but you don't obviously know the ins and outs of what it might be like for the individual if you're having that accessibility. And myself being self-employed, to be employed, imagine you might have been with GCN, can be quite a hard challenge to go from managing your own time to someone dictating your time. Is that right?
Yeah, it was a real culture shock. And to have every single decision or activity that you conduct questioned was really difficult as well. You could walk to the coffee machine and someone will look at you as if to say, well, it's the second trip you made this hour. How dare you leave your computer? Whereas, you know, in the real world, you're allowed to move around and come and go as you need to in order to achieve what it is you're setting out to achieve. And that was a real struggle. You know, I don't need someone holding my hand every 5 seconds throughout the day. I need to be able to be my own person. And that just wasn't the case.
You found, obviously, down in Cornwall, so you got a great place to live and work down there as well. So being a Devon boy, I know, you know, you got a playground on your doorstep. How do you find now managing your time, and what's sort of a typical week for you in terms of how you work with Nicole and yourself, you know, in terms of putting out content and supporting the staff and the clients that you work
with? Yeah. So I think 2.5 years into working with Nicole, we now have a nice routine and a nice rhythm throughout the week. Like the start of the week is all about preparation. The middle of the week, we have a period of delivery. And then the end of the week is just looking ahead to what we can do in the future. You know, some of the time is spent daydreaming about what we can do next year. Some of the time is spent creating other things that need to be delivered. It's nice. It has a good routine to it. And there's never any surprises really in our role. So I actually work with my wife, Micah, at Nicole, and she films everything. So anything you ever see of me that's been filmed is most likely filmed by her these days. And that, again, that makes it really easy to be flexible for school runs and things like that. And then we can go and spend time outside filming, which is nice, and trying to find locations that look unique or look different. So a little bit of time each week is spent trying to do that. The challenge that we set for ourselves, really, I think long term, is to try and create something that is different to everyone else, which is, it's not that easy, but because she doesn't come from a traditional film background, she comes from a cycling background, so she also has an intrinsic understanding of cycling. Hopefully, as time goes on, we can get closer to what it is that we have in our heads and try and show the world cycling through our eyes and with our advice attached to it.
How do you personally view yourself, like the content that's going out a lot now within cycling? I mean, it's got massive recently in terms of a lot of other channels and people doing their own sort of fly on the wall rides and stuff. It was great to expose a sport. How have you found the transition, and are you seeing any sort of clear links and directions and where people are going, or people or opportunities for yourself to maybe put it in a different spin? So
I think anything that's borderline clickbait should be banned, and anyone that uploads videos with only capital letters in their titles should also be taken down immediately. I don't know. It seems to be a very who shouts loudest world, and I don't like that. I think being really authentic and having really good, relatable videos or advice is the direction that I would prefer to take, even if that ultimately sacrifices views or potential for growth. I just think it's so important to be who you really are and not pretend to be someone else. If you are out in the street or out on a bike ride and you happen to meet someone, I think it's really important that you're the same person that you pretended to be on a video or didn't pretend to be, because you are the same person. And that was something which I really learnt in my time in media so far, is what you see is not always what you expect.
Did you find there was a position potentially on GCN that you have to be a certain, you know, yourself? And then they always say turn up another few bars, don't they, when you're on camera. Did you find that you might have portrayed a slight outside of yourself within that environment compared to some of your own video?
Yeah, hopefully there's a difference. I mean, I was always myself, but it was never comfortable. And I think that was the issue, was it was never done in an authentic and comfortable manner. And I really struggled with that. And now I have the opportunity to be me. And I'm very pleased that I can. It's exhausting if you're not, I think, ultimately.
And have you got any exciting projects coming up that you'll keep a lookout for as well?
I think so.
Playing around with a few more camera angles.
Yeah.
I'm interested in getting the Insta360 myself. But yeah, it looks anything that we could be looking out for in the future.
I think so. So I think next year, ultra endurance is growing. It's a really relatable aspect of cycling. We can all aspire to race and we can all aspire to be really fast or set Strava times or do race events. But ultimately, we could all get on our bikes and keep moving and moving as long as our brain enables us to. It's something which intimidates me massively because I don't really enjoy being tired. I spent a lot of my life feeling tired from cycling. But at the same time, the feeling of achievement from completing any sort of ultra endurance event is almost unrivaled, really. It's a very unique feeling. It's not quite the same as winning a bike race. It's not that intense emotional release. It's a feeling of contentment, and you get to spend the whole day riding a bike. So I think it's safe to say to expect that direction to be explored a little bit more, certainly as time goes on. We can blame Alec Boswell, who I ride at home with quite, well, not this year, but normally I would ride with quite a lot. He's a very late comer to cycling. He's a year younger than I am. He's done almost exclusively ultra endurance events since he started. And it's really opened my eyes to what someone can achieve. Now, I don't think I'll have the same success as Alex. He's quite special, but I would like to have the same experiences. And I think that's the direction that things will start to take for me. Just accepting that I don't need to chase that peak performance in the same way that I used to, but that actually by relaxing a little bit and enjoying cycling more, you can enjoy it more by riding further. And that's where I see things going.
Yeah. And definitely the growth in those endurance events now are getting bigger. You're seeing a lot more people tackling those opportunities and those opportunities being open to more people, like the Trans Pennine and all those kind of things. In terms of your training and how you look after your body now, you're getting a bit older. I'm a few years older than yourself, so I know you have to look after it and manage it a bit differently as you know, I'm 40 now, but how has your training changed and how do you tend to view your training in comparison to maybe how you did when you were, you know, riding as a professional?
So that's an interesting one because I don't truly know the answer. So when I was a professional, I would ride to a training plan and I loved it. I loved that I was really strict with it. I would pedal almost exactly to the watt that was described. And that was a sense of achievement came from there, to the point that I probably almost enjoyed training at the time more than racing, certainly at different times. Whereas now, I don't necessarily like training as much as I used to. I love riding my bike more, if not more than ever. But actually sticking to a certain power and sticking to strict intervals, I think I've reached the end of how much I'd like to do that. And that's been quite a realization this year. This year, I actually wanted to return to a good level of racing again, purely to make a video. I thought it'd be entertaining to try and do the Rutland Cycle Classic in the UK, but a real illness got in the way of that, unfortunately. But in the quest to try and achieve this, I was doing lots of intervals. And whilst I enjoyed it at the time, after the illness, when I was trying to get back to the fitness, ultimately fitness that I was never able to regain, that's when it started becoming a little bit too hard and it lost the enjoyment because I wasn't feeling as good as I wanted to at certain numbers, which meant that I didn't, with training to power and things like that, you need to have a certain amount of something extra. It's not just motivation or determination. There's a level of almost adrenaline that you need in order to push and try and set personal bests. And that just wasn't there at all. It's almost like I was lacking energy. And I think after April this year, I found it really hard to actually train to anything other than just feel. And that's been a big change. So I think it's safe to say that over the last 5 years, on and off, I've enjoyed training to a strict schedule. But actually, as time's gone on, training on feel, how much energy do I have on that day? What sort of intervals do I personally feel would benefit my feeling? I don't necessarily need to be fit enough for a specific event. I think my base level of fitness will carry me through any event that I wish to do. So the feeling that I'm looking for is more a feeling of well-being than anything else now. So as long as if I go out, I would never do 5 minutes on, 5 minutes off intervals. Yeah, I've almost rarely ever done them, but I certainly wouldn't do that. But I might do a 45 second maximum sprint because there's a hill near me that has a Strava KOM on it that I maybe want set or somebody else has got, and I'd like to try and beat that time. Those are the sorts of intervals or the training sessions that I like to do now, where you have a sense of achievement. You're still doing good quality efforts, but they're very sporadic and they're based on feel and the feeling of well-being that comes after them.
How is like a training week for you normally? Is it quite relaxed in that sense where you just get out and go for a ride, and it could be an hour or 2 hours depending on, you know, time and how you feel in, you know, feel yourself?
Yes. Right. So I do still like to ride to time. Duration, I think, is the most beneficial way of quantifying your training. So I would try and set myself and also negotiate the time with my wife and children at home. So on the weekend, it's actually quite hard to get out, but I could leave early on a Monday morning and do a few hours before work, for example. So I think as we go into the winter, spending a lot of time thinking about next year at the moment. So my yearly calendar still follows the traditional cycling season. So we get to September, October, ready to have a little bit of a rest. So that's very much now. So I ride the e-mountain bike as often as possible. That's one of my favorite things to do. You still get all the benefits of being outside mentally, and you still have the physical feeling of being on a bicycle, but it's not fatiguing at all if you don't want it to be. Yeah. So I think going forwards, it would be a long ride on a Monday morning before I start work, because I finish late on a Monday. We host the Zwift ride in the evening, so that could be my long training day. And then on a Tuesday, I can afford to do a little bit less, so I can include some intensity. And a Wednesday, well, on a Tuesday and a Wednesday, we now host Zwift rides anyway, so that takes care of some of that training. But I need the time outside as well. That's still really important. So I could warm up on the trainer, do the session, and then go outside, add on an extra hour and a half. I don't really ever feel the need to ride much more than an hour and a half. And that's instantly 2.5 hours, plus a long ride on the Monday, Thursday rest, Friday, 45 minute warm up. And then I could do a ride on a Saturday as well. Manage one day a weekend, and then we can have a family day on the Sunday, for example. That's the sort of rhythm and routine. And then that's mixed between different disciplines. I reference the e-bike a lot because it's sat there, I'm looking at it. And it sits there and it asks and it begs you to ride, and you go out and you ride, and you ride at a really nice cadence on an e-bike, actually, because to keep the motor in its most efficient, well, not most efficient, but to help it deliver the most power possible, it works best with a good cadence. And you come back from riding that feeling really quite good. It's almost like you've ridden on the track, actually, because you try and pedal as much as possible on them as well. So balancing the road bike and the mountain bikes out, we have some really good off-road trails here, which are nice, like gravel, soft gravel trails where you can just go and ride away from traffic. That's quite enjoyable as well. So including lots of endurance work and sprint work is really my favorite thing. Because I don't ride as much as I used to, my sprint numbers are, I'm riding on fresh legs a lot of the time. My sprint numbers are then relatively comparable to what they were when I was racing. I'm not trying to lose weight. I try to sustain a healthy weight, but I don't try to lose weight. I do strength training now as well for the first time, resistance training. And those things mean that peak power is quite achievable. So it's nice to still have a goal that's relatable to what I was doing when I was racing, and it's still able to show progress. So that's quite a good motivator as well.
Yeah, good. And how have you found strength training to help benefit your cycling? Because that's something that I really try and promote, especially men and women as we get older, because we lose muscle mass about 1% a year as we get older, so from the age of 40. So something that I really am quite passionate about getting my clients. I'm passionate about training in the gym at least once a week in the summer, twice a week in the winter when you're maybe not riding as much. How have you found incorporating more weight training into your program now to benefit your cycling yourself?
I think it's easy to think it's boring. It's because you're not outside and you're not moving. And I think for a lot of cyclists, that's probably why they like activity. They like to be out and about and moving. But to counteract that, I think it's the single most beneficial thing I've ever done to help improve cycling performance. So in 2020, that was the first time I ever did any real structured strength training for a period of more than, I think we did it for 3 or 4 months, actually. So throughout the whole lockdown period, building into lockdown, and I've never done anything that's benefited me as much.
I agree. And I've got just a few more questions to ask you regarding the state of the software industry, really. But a few questions that have come in regarding accessibility of getting into the sport and how much that's become more challenging now over the years. Yeah. Initially, what's your take on that yourself before I ask you the questions, just so I've got like a general perspective of how you feel like British cycling and how the opportunities for, you know, younger riders and even older amateur riders maybe trying to do sportifs and events that are accessible to people in the UK.
Yep. I think it's a very challenging time. I think that's the only way of summing that one up. It's incredibly cost prohibitive now. Bikes are so expensive. The cost of entries is expensive. Travel. I don't know how a young rider would go about becoming a professional cyclist in the way that I did, where you had the freedom to go and spend time abroad with no restrictions, because we were in the EU. It was a lot easier. I think it's still possible to get into cycling. Equipment doesn't make as big a difference as everyone likes you to believe. I think that's one thing to remember. I think whilst a fast bike is undeniably fast, it's a few watts faster. It's not going to make the difference between someone being able to win the race or not, most likely at the level that most people compete. You know, the ultimate, the top end of the professional ranks, then it makes a difference. But for most of us, there's enough difference between the people on the start line that the bike isn't going to be the deciding factor in the race. You know, tactical decisions, positioning in the bunch, and your own physical ability will be more important than the bike. So you don't need to spend a huge amount of money on a bicycle, whilst bicycles are more expensive than ever. The race entries, they are quite extreme these days, aren't they? I know that organizers do their absolute best and that they have costs that they need to cover. But short of, you know, selecting a few races throughout the year that you choose to target rather than completing a full season, it's very hard to work around the race costs and then the travel to get to the events. I think if you want to get into cycling as a participatory sport and you don't have aspirations of competing lots or at a high level, then it's probably a better time than ever to take part in cycling. Budget bikes are much better now than they were 20 years ago. The technology on a more affordable bike is genuinely really very good. And they're no less enjoyable to ride. If you ride that bike every day, that becomes your normal and you will enjoy riding that bike no matter what level it is. So I think there's an extreme of, yes, it's a better time to be involved in cycling. There's more knowledge out there. You can become better sooner. And training is something that's easier for everyone to do to a good level correctly. But on the other end of it, if you want to really reach the pinnacle of the sport, it is probably more challenging than it's ever been as a newcomer. Yeah. If you're a young rider, it doesn't mean it's not possible. It just means that you will be faced with a few more hurdles than riders were 20 years ago.
What do you think in terms of the safety aspects? I did watch your video when it came to talking about the Wally Cripper ride.
The Wally Gimber, yeah.
You mentioned Wally Gimber, sorry. My apologies, but you did mention, yeah, you mentioned about the tragic death of Junior Heffernan.
Yeah,
because I actually used to run with him in my local running club, Plymouth Harriers, years ago.
Oh, wow.
And actually went to his memorial cycle ride, you know, not long after it happened. And it touched the nerve when you said that. I was like, oh my God, I can't believe, you know, obviously you're in the same network, so you won't come across him. But the safety aspect of, obviously, the event that you did there and how, you know, that's being managed, you know, in general for, you know, people like yourself that want to go out and race. How do you feel that? Has that been taken on board since you mentioned, obviously, what happened during that race? And it wasn't just you that obviously mentioned the safety risks that were, you know, on display there during that day. So,
yeah, that's an interesting one. So whilst British Cycling contacted me and said they're taking it on board and they wanted to make change, I've not heard from them since, despite trying to contact them, which is disappointing. Yeah. I think change is going to be challenging and change will be uncomfortable. I think the current format of hosting amateur bike racing in the UK is no longer sustainable for safety, for cost. And I think there needs to be something that prevents an accident happening again. Ultimately, the roads are busy. The roads are really busy. Everyone drives on the road. They drive from point A to point B, and they believe they have the right to reach point B with as little obstruction as possible. Whether that's right or wrong, I don't know. There's a real culture of, I'm paying my vehicle excise duty, I should be on the road. But that isn't really, you know, no one has a right more than anyone else to be on the road. You know, a horse rider, a child walking, a person on a bicycle, a tractor, everyone has equal right to use the roads. That's the way it is. It's not that one demographic owns it. So I think short of a large public education on what the roads are for and how we're meant to use them, and a real cultural shift in mentalities towards other groups of humans, it's not likely to change. So therefore, we need to try and keep road racing safe and move it away from these busy areas. Maybe just because a road circuit's been used for 50 years, it doesn't mean it's still safe to continue using it. And maybe we have to accept that road racing, it's a very small sport and it is going to obstruct people. Maybe we need to move it somewhere where we can continue to host it, but it doesn't get in the way of people unless they really want to go and see it. And I think there has to be a way of making everyone happy. There has to be a way of keeping the local people happy, because the race isn't necessarily going through a busy village. It's not holding up loads of traffic on a busy Sunday morning, or the racing needs to be at a different time of day so that those aren't issues. So either later in the evening or earlier in the morning, or it just needs to be taken away into a place that it's easier to manage. I know that some of the NEG riders aren't super happy about the way that they are sort of tasked with holding back traffic. And I know that they feel uncomfortable doing it more and more increasingly because of the response from other road users. So that also has to change. Does that mean that there has to be a more official police involvement? Well, then that comes with an extra cost, which makes it more prohibitive, and then entries go up. I think it's a difficult one. And I know that other countries are struggling with this as well. I know that in the Netherlands, which is typically quite a country that's favorable towards cyclists, certainly as transport rather than as a recreational sport, they also are losing police support to host their events. And that's partly because of resource and partly because of cost. So it's going to become more challenging for them as well. And I think maybe that's something that we're going to see in other places slowly as well. The Netherlands often do things ahead of other nations, and then you see that happens there as well. That's because it's a small country that is quite concentrated with a large population. So things happen there sooner. It's going to be a challenge. I don't know what the right answer is. I think education is a huge part of it. I think the riders need to be educated on the safety of racing in a bunch, because we have a lot of new cyclists that haven't perhaps had the same technical education as some of the older cyclists. If you've not come from a youth cycling club where you're taught essential skills, where do you learn those essential skills? You don't need to qualify to ride a road race. You just need to put your name on a license and apply to ride the race. So maybe part of acquiring a license, you need to do some sort of physical assessment to check. All other countries do a physical assessment to make sure there are no underlying health conditions, like a heart issue. That doesn't happen in the UK.
Yeah.
So maybe that's something. Maybe the acquisition of a racing license should be a bit more expensive, but then some of that money goes towards making racing safer for everyone. So whether that's a technical education, a health assessment, or safer environment for racing. I would still love to speak to British Cycling and actually create an answer. I know they have a strategic group that they've put in place, which is a nice fancy title. So hopefully they can actually create some sort of change.
Yeah, it's definitely what's needed, isn't it, in terms of giving more people confidence to get into cycling in that sense, and just feel confident that they can feel safe and looked after. During that, I know I do a lot of sportives, very few are on closed roads, so you still have to be really, really mindful of how you're riding and looking after others around you. Talking about, you made some really good points there, Chris, but just going back to like a previous point as well. I'm just going to throw at you a couple of questions now that have been asked from a couple of viewers, which is based around what we just discussed with cycling. The first question was, what does Chris think about what could be done to make road racing more affordable to the average working person? As a license and membership can be nearly £100 plus entry fees and travel costs, there's no wonder why potentially grassroots is suffering massively. While British Cycling Team can, you know, get in potentially maybe all the funding. What's your opinion on that? Or how would you answer that question?
Yeah, I think the governing body, how much money did they have from Shell? Millions, wasn't it? It was a huge investment from Shell.
Yeah.
that money should be used to nurture the grassroots of sport. And whether that's introducing people to cycling as transport, or people that want to take cycle sport more seriously, whether that's providing an environment for them to do that, I think it needs real consideration. I don't see any reason why British Cycling shouldn't subsidise events. I know they're an organisation that also wants to make a profit, but part of their responsibility should be taking care of the sport of cycling. And I'm sure they do. And I'm sure it's work that is very, very difficult for us to see from the outside. But I do feel they should perhaps be more transparent in what it is they're actually doing, so that if they're doing as much as is feasibly possible, then they should make that really clear, and they should have a breakdown of what it is they've done throughout the last 12 months made public, so that we can all feel at ease of, oh yes, okay, well, they do care. They are listening. They are watching. They are paying attention to the lower levels of the sport, the entry levels of the sport, so that it can continue to thrive as it did in the past. Or, yeah, the councils don't have any money anymore either, do they? So that's not going to help.
So thank you for tuning in to this week's episode. Again, apologies for the lost audio at the end there, but I hope you enjoyed our chat with Chris Opie this week. If you haven't done so far and you are enjoying the podcast, then please head over to iTunes or Spotify. Leave us a nice little 5-second review. It'll take you that long to do so. Really help out the show and get it out to more people. And also, it'd be nice to know what kind of feedback I'm getting from the listeners like yourself, and see if you're enjoying the show and what kind of guests would you like on the show in the future. And also, if you are someone listening and you are in the world of cycling or health and fitness and you would like to come on the show, then reach out to the email in the show notes and we can get you on as a guest. It'd be good to speak to more people within the industry. So if you are interested, then reach out. But thank you very much for listening and watching this week. And we'll see you next time.